Because my partner, Adam, thought we would lose all of our clients because of that. And the funny part about the existing clients is that, yeah, some of them did push back a little bit. But after we did it a couple times, you know, after we talked about showing how it worked and we were working through it, the trust was there. And I think that was the big part. They trusted us that we weren't going to do anything shady or do anything ridiculous or whatever. But we also gave them the ability to cancel anytime they want to. If you don't like our service, you know what? Just cancel right away.
Diving into an episode that is going to inspire you with tales of growth and scaling from one of our guests. Today's guest is going to be special because we hand select people who are actively building and growing their businesses, people who know what it feels like to be in your position. As a listener of this podcast, trying to figure out what your next growth steps are, and they're going to share with us those insights, that journey, and what they're doing right now to position themselves in a better place for growth and scaling. So check it out if you haven't done so already and subscribe to our channel. We are bringing some awesome business leaders into your circle, into your headphones, into your computer monitor today to show you what you can be doing to grow and scale your business. Share the love, subscribe to the channel, and at the end of this episode, to see what you should be doing next to grow and scale your business. Hey, welcome back to the show. I am so excited today to have Jody on, and he's going to tell us why. Jody, who are you, and what are you doing?
Who am I? Good question. I ask that myself a lot. Jody Grundin. I'm basically a co-founder of Summit CPA Group, which now I'm a partner at Anders, and so a large CPA firm. So we founded the concept Virtual CFO Service, created a subscription-based billing model in that process, and then went fully remote. Probably 12 years ago or so. Kind of doing things a lot differently than what, basically the mission of changing the way people think about accounting. And that goes from the accountants to the general public to the accounting profession. And so,
In what way?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when we first started, it was like, you know, hey, what, you know, I worked in public accounting and I actually got fired from a public accounting firm, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
I was told I would never be successful in public accounting. Just my personality and everything. I was like, well, that was a kind of a setback, but it's kind of a challenge too. And I went to the corporate world.
But they don't think you're serious enough, or what? You got to be boring.
You know, it's like, you know, accountants are kind of in a box, and they don't get outside that box very often. Well, I live outside the box, and that is something that's not natural for a lot of public accountants. You know, they don't know how to really deal with somebody like me generally. You know, occasionally they do, but you know, generally don't. And the corporate life, I thought, you know, hey, that's got to be my place to live. And that was completely different too. It was Groundhog Day. You know, once I figured everything out and streamlined everything, man, it was just the same thing over and over and over again. And I knew that wasn't going to be the way that I wanted to live the rest of my life either. And so I thought, well, I'll try this entrepreneurial thing. My dad and my mom kind of both dabbled in it a little bit. My dad owned a photography business. Mom owned a flower shop. And I thought, well, hey, let's figure this out. And so I dove in and with the idea that, hey, I want to do things differently. I don't want to be the corporate world. I don't want to be the public accounting world. And so I started right away with dressing differently. It was like back 20 some years ago, you had to wear suits, ties, all the accountants did it. You know, that was just the norm. And I thought, no more suits and ties. We're going to dress like normal people. And so that was number one. And then the second thing is that hourly bill, you know, when I worked in public accounting, and I say worked in public accounting, worked for a different firm. You know, it was like people called me and called me and called me until eventually they didn't. And they didn't because they got that first bill. And I was like, well, they don't want to call me anymore because they knew they're on the clock and they knew my fees were big. And it's like, well, geez, maybe I can figure this out myself. And what happened was they tried to figure it out. And it was a disaster when I actually got it. So I thought, well, how can I do that differently? And so I created a service. Basically, I turned a service, you know, virtual CFO or accounting or forecasting, all that kind of stuff, into a product.
Right.
And with that product, I was able to create what we call subscription-based billing. And, you know, back then in 2004, when we started rolling it out, it was so foreign.
That was not normal.
No, people didn't know what it was. Netflix wasn't even around doing it. And it was so different that I got called in front of the accounting, you know, ethics committee. I got turned into the ethics committee saying, hey,
you can't
pull money out of people's accounts. And then they finally looked at it. And they said, no, you're fine as long as you got the engagement letter, it's signed and all that kind of stuff. But it was so foreign to accountants that they.
Oh, my gosh.
They thought, you know, it was just so different. Right. And so we created this monthly subscription billing where we billed in advance. And then clients were, you know, wanting us to be more, you know, with a virtual CFO service where we actually meet with clients, right, go through forecasting, KPIs, that sort of thing. And they wanted to meet with us on a more frequent basis than monthly, you know, because they wanted us to be kind of part of their team. And sure, so we're like, hey, yeah, we can meet with you weekly. And so we started meeting with clients weekly. And when we did that, we thought, you know what, why are we billing monthly? Why don't we just bill weekly? And so we changed our subscription rate to a weekly model where we could actually just zap their account every Monday. Yeah, which is a cool concept. And I still don't know many firms doing it or any other industries really, you know, zapping, you know, clients' accounts on Mondays. They love it because it's not, you don't have that big bill at the end of the month. You know, it's a regular cadence that they know what to expect. And it just made it so much easier for us. We didn't have an accounts receivable. We grew it to $10 million. We had no accounts. It was actually negative, if you want to look at it.
Oh, my gosh.
It was billed on Monday before that we actually did the service. And so you can kind of imagine the cool positive thing for us. But for the positive thing for them is they knew what it was. It was no surprise. It wasn't like they opened up the mailbox, saw our bill, and it's like, oh, geez, I didn't realize I talked to you guys that much. You know, we wanted them to actually call us. You know, that was the key. And so we wanted to make it so consistent that it was just something that was an ordinary, like we were an employee of the company. And that worked out really well.
I love it. Holy cow. Yeah, I mean, and accountants seem to have jumped onto that model very quickly, mm-hmm, because it feel like of all the professional services that are needed at the top of a company, accountant or CFO, I feel like there's a lot of fractional CFO companies out there now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Whereas there's not a lot of fractional legal officers, not a lot of fractional marketing officers. I mean, there is now, but only in the past 2 or 3 years.
Yeah,
CFOs have been doing this for a while.
Yeah, since COVID, really. I mean, when we started doing it, the concept was so weird that we called it virtual CFO. And not because, you know, we made the name up. I looked into the sources. We found out later that that name had been used otherwise once the internet really kind of picked up. But with that, it was like people didn't know what it meant. And it's like they weren't used to it. And it was like, well, hey, we can bring that corporate, you know, structure down to an individual, you know, an individual small business. And you know, why not? Why can't the, you know, small business have the same luxury that a $250 million manufacturing company might have? You know, and it's like, you know, that was the concept. And it wasn't just simply doing the accounting, you know, the behind the scenes paying bills. It wasn't necessarily that. I mean, although we do that for like a third of our clients, it was the forecasting side. You know, hey, what happened yesterday? How does that impact the next 12 months? What does your balance look like? What's your cash position look like? How much debt do you have? Are we going to pay down in the next 12 months? That's what the client really wanted to see. You know, how could they impact it? But not necessarily just the numbers, but they wanted to know how truly could they impact it. You know, if they're, whatever type of company, you know, they might be, you know, how many widgets do I have to sell in order to get that? Or how many service cases, how many people do I have to employ? How many hours do I have to build a client? All that kind of stuff that they could control. And that was the kind of the beauty of the model, which allowed us to grow, allowed the clients to grow, which was the nice thing. We really saw an impact where, you know, prior to that, it was just simply regurgitating stuff they already did. You know, that wasn't too fulfilling for me. And, you know, I wanted to take that information and show them, hey, here's how you apply it. Here's how you grow it. And we've had many companies just love it.
And I can attest as a small business owner, every time you're on an hourly type program, you feel so nickel and dimed. And it's like, dude, I just want to ask you a quick question. You charge me an hour for that?
Exactly.
You know, it's horrible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And think about that. If you're meeting with a client on a weekly basis, that conversation happens all the time. And so we had to get rid of it. And that's where the subscription-based billing model really picked up pace and was super, super instrumental for our growth. You know, I don't think we could have grown at the speed that we did grow without.
I love it. You know, and another thing you bring up in service industries, it's awfully hard to feel justified billing ahead of when you're actually performing services. But you've been able to pull this off. What do you feel like? I'm sure you met friction early on. But how were you able to kind of implement that in a way that your customers felt like, yeah, I'm cool with that?
It's kind of funny. We felt no friction. So we once we decided to go to the model, every new client that we went with, here's how we did it, and they signed up. You know, no friction whatsoever. We never got any pushback, you know, saying, hey, we'd like to bill at the end. You know, no one's ever. I close a lot of the deals myself, and no one's ever brought that up. It's like, you know, hey, here's how we do it. Because it's just a matter of fact, they're looking for our service. We're super transparent on our website. And with that, you know, it's like even in the sales call, you know, it's an hour long sales call. You know, we basically figure out what their needs are. We prescribe what we think is good. And we give them a dollar amount. super easy, super simple. And, you know, with that, you know, the client just loved that process. And it's kind of funny because we also, in our first 8 weeks, we double our fee, because a lot of times we're setting things up, we're doing the, setting up KPIs, the forecasting, really digging in deep, cleaning up all the garbage that we get, you know, for the accounting side. And with that takes a long time. And so we even tell the client, you know, the first 8 weeks, we're going to double your fee. And so if it's $1,500 a week, now it's $3,000 a week through 8 weeks. And week nine, it goes to the $1,500. You know, occasionally we'll get a client, they'll ask us, hey, can we spread that over a longer period of time instead of 8 weeks? We're like, yeah, that's not a problem. And we can make adjustments for it. But outside of that, you know, really no pushback on people billing ahead. And it's funny you mentioned that, because my partner, Adam, thought we would lose all of our clients because of that. He's like, oh, you're going to lose all your clients. They're not going to do that. And the funny part about the existing clients is that, some of them did push back a little bit. But after we did it a couple times, you know, after we talked about showing how it worked and we were working through it, they didn't. You know, the trust was there. And I think that was the big part, you know, that they trusted us, that we weren't going to do anything shady or do anything ridiculous or whatever.
Right.
But we also gave them the ability to cancel anytime they want to. And so it's not like you're signing up for a year and you got to stick with us and you got to pay that bill. Right. It's like, you know what? If you don't like our service, you know what? Just cancel right away. And that allowed for, you know, because we try to reduce in our sales call the barrier of entry, because that's the important part. If you can get rid of all those no's ahead of time, and then all of a sudden now it's just yeses, your closing ratio is going to be better. The success ratio is going to be better. The customer satisfaction is going to be better going all the way through it. And so that was just one of the barriers that we had, you know, hey, how can we make it so simple
for clients to
understand how we charge, how they pay, and then do they have the flexibility to cancel?
I love it. You know, that's so awesome. I don't even know where to go. There's a million places to go with what you just talked about, because there are so many industries and so many people that struggle with invoicing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I find myself in that boat often as a fractional CMO, mm-hmm. where I try to bill ahead of time, but then again, I don't know where the expenses are going to fall because of variables like, you know, how much we spend on Google, how much we're doing here and there and everywhere. Mm-hmm. And what you're doing is such an awesome strategy of just maintaining full transparency, pay as you go, kind of a feeling. And mm-hmm. I think everybody does like that. Even in the service industry, that's a really, really smart play.
Yeah. And you think about because software has been doing it for a while, right? And you think about the softwares that you have to lock yourself into a year versus those that you can cancel anytime or just
month to month. Monthly.
Which one do you pick? Yeah. If they're very similar in quality, you're going to pick the month to month, right?
Always.
And you might have that thing for years, and you know you're going to have it for years, but you still pick the month to month because you always have that.
I know.
That flexibility.
We're weird like that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, another thing is that you have to be able to accept win some, lose some. And what do I mean by that? When you have a subscription-based billing, I say that, you know what, your service is going to be $90,000 a year, which equates to $1,750, whatever it is, you know, a week.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes I'm going to, you know, look at my profit margins, and that's going to be a 50% client when I need to have 75% in order to make, you know, the world go around. And other times it's going to be an 85% or 90% client. And so I've got to be able to accept the losses as well as the wins, knowing that the average client that we have is at that 75%, which makes the world go around. And that's a tough pill for a lot of people to swallow, because they want to be super hyper profitable on everybody. And you know what, if you're greater than 75, that's great. That's icing on the cake. Whereas we look at it as, well, that keeps the average where we need it to be, you know, cause you're going to win some and you're going to lose some, and you're going to lose clients. You're going to lose some on profitability. You're not going to lose on profitability, but you're not going to get the margins that you want on every client is what I mean by that. And
I love it.
It's tough. You know, some people can't handle that. You know, that's a mental thing that you have to get over with if you do the subscription based model like we're talking about.
Right. Well, you know, I typically like to ask people what key decisions trigger the most growth. And clearly this is one of the key decisions that you made to initiate a huge propensity to grow your business. Looking back on that decision, you've kind of talked about, you know, some of the nervousness and some of that. What kind of advice do you give other people who are trying to initiate something significant like that? I mean, this is a, you know, for those that don't truly understand the breadth of what you're talking about, this is a huge shift in your industry. What do you tell people who are thinking about doing that in their industry?
Yeah, it's a great question, because there's really has to be a pain, you know, pain point before you make any kind of change, right? change right. management 101. My pain point was is that I bootstrapped the company back in 2002. Lived on my credit cards for a couple of years. I wouldn't recommend that to sure. anybody. You know, do not do that. Sure. But I had to. That's only, I didn't have a nest egg. I didn't have a huge 401k I could pull out of. I literally started with hardly any money at all. And so when we first right. started off, you know, being the bank for a client was tough. And I mean, yeah. meaning yeah. when you have accounts receivable, you're truly the bank for a client. And when the client yeah. forgets to pay or delays payment, everybody's had that experience. You're like, oh, I hope I get that check so I can make payroll. That is a brutal experience as a business owner. That's probably one of the most gut-wrenching experiences really you can have. And when it doesn't come in, then you're like, oh, how am I going to do this? I cut my pay down, or I have to juggle things around right. in order to do it. And I couldn't do that anymore because our AR was getting so big that I just couldn't do that mentally. And so my pain point was I had to figure a solution out. An alternative out. And with that, yeah. that's how I came up with the subscription billing. So the alternative wasn't just simply to start billing people ahead of time, because we were billing by the hour their first 2 years. You know, we were doing yeah. it the same way everybody else was doing it, the only way I knew to do it. It wasn't until then that we had to decide, you know, hey, how can we do this so that it's reoccurring, that I don't have an AR and then creating that expense. So that was my big pain point. You know, with your big pain point, and I mean, anybody out there's big pain point, maybe it's, I just don't like chasing people around. Maybe it's I don't want to be right. that, you know, I don't want to be the debt collector all the time. Or maybe that's, you know, that just really ruins the relationship period. Or, you know, hey, there's got to be that pain point that you might have. And once you have that pain point, then you got to figure out, okay, now is the opposite. You know, if I go this direction, which might be a subscription billing or it might be something different, you know, right. what are all the alternatives? So the alternatives are, here are the three different alternatives we might have. This is the one I like the best, and here's why I like it. It's like the Ben Franklin close, where you have pros on one side sure. and cons on the other, and you kind of list them out and you kind of worry about it. But don't analyze it, overanalyze it. When you start overanalyzing it, then what happens is you just get paralyzed. You don't do it. And so that's what you've got to do. Figure out the alternatives and then decide you're going to do it. And I tell the story yeah. all the time about my father-in-law, who very successful, great guy. You know, there's a McDonald's on the corner that he wanted to put up, you know, and he talked about it for the longest time, how I'm going to put this up, how I'm going to do all this, do all that. And, you know, right. this went on for about 10 years. And then finally, guess what? McDonald's on the corner. And guess who didn't own it? He didn't own it, you know, because he got paralyzed by his decisions. He just never pulled the trigger to do it. And that McDonald's yeah. was extremely successful. Could have been a life-changing event for him had he actually pulled that trigger. And so, you know, for a lot of us, you know, hey, entrepreneurs in particular take risk a lot more than a typical employee type of relationship sure. would have. And so the entrepreneur just has to pull the trigger. Once they've done the due diligence on doing the research, figuring out if it's the best solution, just got to pull the trigger and do it.
Love it. Love it. So true. Oh, I would say that the vast majority of people who are entrepreneurial do pull triggers a lot. They pull mm-hmm. the triggers a lot, probably more than they should.
Absolutely.
But for those that have come from a corporate background, and I would like to say probably the vast majority of the service industry, like professional services, like a CPA or a legal person or those types of personality types, I guess you could say, mm-hmm. you're obviously not the general personality type of a CPA,
right?
Clearly.
Right.
But those that are, they do hesitate. They tend to overthink. They tend to over-strategize. They never quite pull the trigger with the thing they actually want to do. What do you, you know, those listening on the show, what do you tell them to kind of get them over that hump? And what is the driver that they need to be thinking about to initiate that stuff?
You know, they just have to do it. The biggest thing is that fear of failure, right? And I don't know about you, but I failed a lot more than I've been successful. Tried many, many things, many marketing right. techniques that just didn't go well or didn't pan out. I've tried, you know, many different things. And, you know, with that, my philosophy, my thinking is that this is just it's a small rock in the way. I'm going to get over that rock right. somehow. You know, am I going to take a big right. bulldozer and get over that rock, or am I going to have, you know, a little scooter to get over that rock? And what I mean by that is that rock is determined by how much cash I have in the bank. And so if I've got a lot of cash in the bank, I can take risks. And that risk, now I'm the big bulldozer going over the small rock. But if I don't have cash, then I'm kind of the scooter trying to get over it. It's a lot tougher right. to get over that big rock. And so, you know, if you manage your business well enough and you have, say, a 10% annualized cash reserve, meaning that if you're a service-based company, you're $3 million and you've got $300,000 in the bank or close to it, then you have the capability of taking that risk a lot better than the person that doesn't. And so, you know, I would say for those folks, build that cash reserve so that you've got the ability to take risk. You know, hey, is that new hire coming down the road that would be awesome new hire? Maybe it's a business developer that you've always been, you always wanted to hire. And then, you know, if you ask me as a CFO, hey, can I hire that person? The first thing I'm going to do is look and see how much cash you have. Because I know you don't need that person today. But if you got a lot of cash, absolutely. If you feel it's a good idea, take that risk. If you have low cash, I'm going to say, absolutely not. Same person, same situation. The only difference is how much cash you have in the bank will determine that risk. And so I would say for those entrepreneurs out there, don't be afraid to take a risk. For those employees that are moving into that entrepreneur type of relationship, don't be afraid to take the risk. But at the same point, build the cash reserves so that risk can be justified, because 90% of these chances aren't going to work out. You know, I could have easily failed on the subscription-based billing model. Maybe no one would have accepted it, and then I'd have been out of business or whatever. You know, when I went remote, you know, 15 years ago, whenever it was, back in 2013, 2012, you know, that was a big risk, right? But I did my due diligence. I went and looked at things. You know, I had a company that my first client was one of the very first ever fully remote companies, you know, and I looked and see what are they doing right, wrong, and how can I work my system? And then when I presented that to my team, you know, it's like they all said, no, well, we don't want to do it because, you know, they're accountants. Of course, why would they want to do it? They want change. And so, you know, it was one of those deals that I had to make that risk. I had to make that decision. The decision to go remote at that point was, I'm not going to do it, you know, and I actually built on, I own the building. I remodeled the entire building, spent $100,000 remodeling it. Kicked them out for 6 weeks because we completely gutted it. All walls were gone.
Yeah.
You know, with that, it was kind of amazing. You know, they figured out how to work remote in that time frame, and they all loved it. And they're like, you know, hey, I would like to try this remote thing out. It's like, well, I wish I wouldn't have spent $100,000. You could have saved me some money here. You know, that type of thing. Yeah.
Totally.
But the thing was, is that they had to have that confidence in order for them to make that decision to do it. Whereas an entrepreneur, we don't have to make, you know, we've got more confidence that, you know, that's going to go right than what an employee does. But in the same respect, you can't lose your team just by making silly decisions. You really got to work through it and get the buy-in of everybody in order to, you know, really make this happen.
Right. You know, that's a fascinating story. And I 100% agree. And it is a tricky thing, especially with services, professional services, where the people aren't generally as off the wall as a typical, say, marketing minded, founder who generally is just all personality and emotion and a lot less strategic thinking.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yep.
And so as you find that blend between those two personality types, and obviously there's more than just the two, but when it comes to having to think about the strategy and having to think about your finances, having to think about that stuff, I've personally found, as I've talked to more and more founders, that so many of us fail to understand the financial trigger points and our financial statements, that, you know, what is this actually telling me when I only have this much in the bank, but I feel like I've got all this receivable coming in? Or, you know, where do you see, as a CPA and someone who works with a lot of businesses, the biggest misconceptions of business owners when they're trying to read their financials and say, oh, yeah, I can do that? Or no, you should definitely not do that. Are there some commonalities in that?
Yeah, I would say a lot of them have the misunderstanding that if they're in the black, that means they've got tons of cash, you know?
Right.
And what I mean by black, my bottom line says I'm profitable, but where's my cash at? Or they get advised by, you know, a tax professional saying, you know what, drain all of your cash at the end of the year so you don't have to pay taxes on it. And it's like, both of those are completely, completely wrong. You know, with that, the latter, you know, your taxes are really your biggest KPI you could have. You know, if I'm paying a lot in taxes, that means I'm profitable. And with that, that also means that I can keep money in the bank there so that I can make those decisions, you know, that we were talking about earlier. You know, if you keep draining it every year, you can't make those decisions because you're starting your year over and over again, and you're never really getting anywhere. And so, you know, you've got to build the cash. I would say that's a big misconception that a lot of people come in and talk about. You know, being in the black, you know, when I look at a financial statement, it's kind of funny because when we, you know, our CFOs are trained so that when they meet with a client, we're talking about a financial statement, your last month, for about 15 minutes out of an hour conversation. The remainder is the forecast. You know, we're showing you, hey, now here's your financial statements. here's how that's impacting the rest of the year. You know, we thought we were going to have this, you know, $1.2 million bottom line at the end of the year. Well, you know, we had an outstanding month. Now we're looking at $1.5 million. What does that mean? That means we've got an extra maybe $200,000 of cash in the bank at the end of the year. What are we going to do with that cash? Oh, well, let's see. We're going to pay down the line of credit. We're going to, you know, pay maybe a debt off or two. We're going to get our you know, so we're making those the strategic decisions based on how that month happened, even though the future is not hasn't happened yet. You know, the future is looking at that, but we're in our mind, we're making that roadmap and kind of guiding us there. You know, because a lot of people ask, well, how do you grow? And it's like, well, it's growing is just simply, it really is just simply creating that forecast or that map. And then taking actions towards it. It's kind of a weird concept because it's so simple, but it truly is. You know, a lot of founders, you know, they don't have that forecast in the play. And so they're just simply going month by month, year by year. Hey, we're up this much this year. We're down this much this year. Where are you at overall? Well, not, you know, maybe our revenue is growing, but our net income is, I'm not making any more money or whatever that might be. It's because they don't have that roadmap in there. They don't have the forecast in place.
I agree.
And they're not taking actions towards it.
I agree. And I think that, you know, there are, I call it playing spreadsheet millionaire, you know, plug in the variables here and there and see which one's going to get you to your target. For many of us, our games of spreadsheet millionaire aren't always going to work out the way we planned it. Some variables off, some KPI was wrong or impossible to hit. How often do you assess those for people? And when you're building that forecast for people, are you reviewing them weekly, monthly? Like, what should that look like in the eyes of a founder?
That's a great question. I wish I had said that. It's dynamic. Forecasts are always dynamic, meaning you're always doing it at least on a monthly basis. And so when we meet with clients, we actually have a forecasting meeting where we have, you know, we go through and say, hey, how many people we're going to hire? Who are they? Who are they? Well, how much dollar amount? You know, what are we going to spend on their salaries and all that kind of stuff? And so we're really kind of building that forward because every month makes, you know, is going to impact that. I would also say if we're looking to make a big decision. So if it's halfway through the month and we've done our forecast maybe 15 days ago and all this, so this new opportunity pops up, it's important to do it right there. You know, so you have to look at that forecast. Okay, what's going to happen if we do this? You know, what's my cash position going to look like? Is it going to reduce it for a short period of time? Am I going to be able to float it? And then throw a few different scenarios in there. What happens if my customer starts paying a little bit late? How's that going to impact things? So that when you make those informed decisions, they're truly informed. You know, they're not just simply a gut feeling.
Yep.
You know, you can do the gut feeling all you want when you're under $1 million and you'll be right a lot of the time. But once you start getting that $2 million now where you've got a full team and you've got, you know, you've got not only a team, but you've got their spouses and you got their kids. So now you're making decisions going to impact potentially, you know, 100 people, you know, and with that, you know, that as an owner, you've got to have the stewardship to really make informed decisions now and not just simply whatever you think is going to happen, because you mentioned it earlier, you know, Todd, that as entrepreneurs, we're not afraid to take risks. Well, you know, you have to make sure those risks are educated, solid risks, especially, you know, if you're the only person there, take all the risks you want. The only person who's going to impact
is you. Right. Well, you said it perfectly. You are a steward. Like you've been given something, you created something. And the minute you start bringing other people and their families into the mix, you know, your decisions really do affect a lot of people. I'll never forget the first time I had over 100 employees. I looked at payroll and I was like, that's 100 families I've got to feed. Like, everything I do is affecting. I literally had that kind of nervous moment where I was like, suck. And then it got worse the bigger the company got, you know, that feeling. Mm-hmm. And it is a burden. But it's also, you know, when you are a good steward of your responsibility, it also gives you a lot of pride knowing, hey, we are directing a ship that is providing a living for all these amazing people and their families. Yep. Let's keep making good decisions. And I think I love that you brought that up.
Yeah, because it does. I mean, you know, I didn't realize mine until it did hit me hard until we have team retreats. We have two retreats a year. We're fully remote. You know, we've got 75 people here in the U.S. and 15 abroad. And so with that, as we come together every 6 months, it's like, wow, you kind of look over and it's like, wow, look at all these people. And then your head starts calculating, wow, what would this look like if we brought all our families there? You know, we'd have it. Yeah. It'd be giant. And it's like, wow,
no doubt.
The decisions I'm making, my talk that I'm going to have, the importance of it is, is exponential now. It's not just me talking in front of my leadership team. It's me talking in front of a lot of folks that have met me maybe for the first time. And, you know, with that, you know, they're looking for directional where we're heading and what their future is going to look like. And I think it's important to have that and to know that and to understand that. Like I said, especially once you, and you should do it all the time, but once you get to that, you know, $2 million mark, you've got to have it. You've got to have something in play.
Love it. Love it. Wow. This has been a really fun conversation. I wasn't exactly sure going into it where we were going to end off at, but I think we covered some amazing ground here when it comes to growth and scaling. I feel like your journey coupled with forecasting, coupled with stewardship, those really are some of the key core components of any company's ability to grow and scale. And I just feel like if I was listening to this episode, I would feel very well served. And I really appreciate you, Jody, for getting into this with me and touching on as many things as we have in such a short period of time. Anything you feel like that if you were speaking to an audience right now of a few thousand CEOs between $2 and $30 million. Last thoughts.
Yeah, last thoughts would be get a CFO that's going to really kind of help. That's going to help you guide the ship. You know, a lot of times when we bring on, you know, the CFOs at the very beginning, you know, a lot of times it may be a friend of a family or they may be a spouse, whatever, that probably isn't qualified to get there, but has gotten you to the point that you need to. My thing is when you get to that $2 million mark, you know, let's look and see if you can, you know, go out and test the market out and see who's out there, whether you hire externally, like a virtual CFO like ourselves, or internally, it makes really no difference. Whatever makes it work best for you. But I think that the key is you've got to have that person there to be along your side, be along the side and give you the hard news. You know, hey, the tough news, tough love. You know, hey, what decisions you're making are really screwing things up, or the decisions you're making are making us, you know, flourish even better. You know, you need to hear that from a third party, not just a gut feeling, not just a friend or spouse that you've been associated with for a long time.
Love it. Love it. Yeah, fantastic advice. For those listening, you need to have a solid CFO, even whether they're fractional, full-time, or whatever. I personally have used fractional for years. I think it's a smart play. I love your model, Jody, and I would highly suggest you reach out to Jody to get an assessment done on your business. Can they help you find out if the partnership works? You got to have somebody, might as well have someone who's been doing this for a while and can give you the better pointers, because when it comes to finances, you got to know. Like, you can't just guess. Marketing is a guessing game. Finances, you got to know what your numbers are telling you. So, Jody, I love it. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thanks, Todd.
Hey, we hope you enjoyed that episode. As with all of our guests that we've enjoyed on this podcast, we hope you take a minute to reflect on how relevant was that to your growth journey? How relevant is that to your business? If you are not taking steps to grow and scale your business, chances are you're not growing or scaling. So, how do you know if you're growth ready? Check it out at growthreadiness.com. If you haven't done so already, we have a free assessment at growthreadiness.com. That's right, growthreadiness.com. And measure up to see if you truly are growth ready. If that magical amount of funding or that magical client popped into your doorstep today, would you be ready? Could you grow and scale your business with what you've got ready right now? Chances are there are some places you're strong, there's some places you're weak. We let you explore that for free at growthreadiness.com. Click on the assessment at the top right. And we challenge everyone that listens to the podcast to go see how growth ready your business is from your perspective as an owner, founder, operations director, or even a sales manager. Is your company on a path to growth readiness? If it's not, reach out. Let us know what we can do to help. We have tons of resources, tons of free stuff, and some really, really high quality paid stuff that's going to help your company reach that level of growth that you hoped it could be on. Whether you're aiming for exit, whether you're aiming for a fundraise, or whether you're just trying to sustain the growth you've already had, go to growthreadiness.com and check out what you're doing and if it's working for you. Thanks for being a part of the Growth and Scaling podcast. We hope all these interviews are helping you determine the best path for your growth and giving you real world examples of what you could be doing in your business today.